The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
You don't produce a Kieran Kilkenny or an Oisín Mullen. You don't produce them overnight. They take time, takes a lot of work, massive loss for his club, but he's meant for professional sport.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM
with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's move.
Bowes condemned tiny minority for Irish town trouble ahead of cup final, which is a story that's actually evolved over the last 24 hours or so. The Irish Times done a bit of digging on it. You've been doing a bit of digging on it too.
Yeah, there was like the story in the Irish Times is talking about that there could be links to, like, say, English fans who have links to Bohemians.
Yeah, so
club who are over, which is a bit.
Conor Gallagher is their crime correspondent, I think. I don't want to do this as a disservice, and I read it online. I haven't got it in the paper at the moment. But the story was. So if anybody missed this, right, there was a St. Patrick's Athletic fan gathering in Irishtown House, in Irishtown, funnily enough, and it got attacked by people dressed all in black.
Yeah, like one of the paragraphs here is that a Garda investigation is ongoing and no arrests have been made. Garda believed the majority of the violence was not carried out by Bohemians fans, but rather by a group who had travelled over from the UK. Members of this group are believed to be supporters of a UK team which has long-standing association with Bohemians.
Right. I had no idea that any UK team, it says.
Yeah, it's a strange one because, like, I remember, obviously, pre-COVID, it would be quite regular. You would see kind of groups of fans or groups of lads at maybe, say, Dalymount Park or even Richmond Park. Like St Pat's would have a link. It's a strange one to a fan. He's probably passed away with Sheffield United. In terms of, like, they would go over and there would be kind of a bit of a bond there. They would have drinks and all the rest of it, and you'd see a few of them. Like,
there's nothing official. It's just a thing that happens.
Yeah,
fan groups meet fan groups.
I think there could have been a family link in there as well, which is obviously natural as well. And, like, I remember actually going over to Sheffield United, and outside the ground they have, like, a building block, and his name is Hanno, the fellow, the Pats fan who passed away sadly. And but there's actually a kind of one of the blocks is like a mural to him, or kind of outside Bramall Lane. So I'll be honest, I'm not 100% certain. I've heard a different club mentioned of who it could be, but you don't know what the situation is. And it just seems absolutely, absolutely bizarre that, like, a group of people would come over from the UK. And let's be honest, like, the crime correspondent from the Irish Times isn't going to be writing this if it's not well sourced and there's not solid information behind it. So it kind of does shed another light on what's happened, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting as well that the Gardaí are being criticised here. It took at least 10 minutes for the Gardaí to arrive, by which time the violence had stopped. And there was a piece, certainly in the online version last night, that said that Gardaí were annoyed at the fact that such a small crew had been put on. There was only a skeleton crew of public order Gardaí on duty for the FAI Cup final between Bowes and Pats. As I said, this is Conor Gallagher, the crime correspondent in the Irish Times piece, which saw significant violence near the stadium. There was only about a dozen dedicated public order Gardaí on duty, despite the fact there was 37,000 fans at the stadium. Previous games between the teams have attracted significantly more policing resources. Previous games, bear that in mind. And they've never played in the cup final. This is the biggest game ever. So what was going on? Why weren't there more cops?
It is very. You would think that because of the nature of the fact that it's Aviva Stadium, it's a cup final, and that there was going to be close to 40,000 people there, that naturally, I don't know, even by law, would there have to be a certain amount of resources put into it by police? In terms of the previous games, I've been going to matches at Richmond Park between Pats and Bowes probably since I was 9 years of age, and even growing up, like, there's an edge obviously to the games. It's a Dublin derby, but I can't remember ever seeing actual violence between groups of fans, especially not violence in the sense of where it's organised and arranged. Do you know what I mean? It's genuinely not something that's part of a culture, especially in that fixture. Like, it could be, like, I know there's different grades. Like I said, let's be honest, everyone knows that there's a far more of an edge of a derby between Rovers and Bowes and the nature of that. And you go to a game and you do get that sense. Like, I was covering the game on Sunday and got the train in from the Navanor Parkway into Connolly Station, was milling about town for a bit in and around the station there, got to the Aviva, and fans were mixing even in the stadium sitting beside her, but fans were mixing all day, and at no point you would see guards obviously about, but it didn't feel as if it was that kind of an occasion. Yeah. There wasn't that undercurrent or a sense of there was going to be trouble. And then you saw that video that was doing the rounds on social media and you're just obviously appalled. You're like, What is this?
Like, it didn't make any sense. Yeah. Like, we were getting criticised by a lot of people watching the show yesterday. Oh, you need to call this what it is. It just didn't make it. If it had been a bunch of lads dressed in Bose gear and...
But that, the thing is, with football hooliganism as well, you won't get lads dressed in fan colours doing it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, you've seen the Man United Leeds videos that did the rounds after that game, where it was clear they were fans from the two sides who were clashing in the city centre and walking past. People were having their lunch, walking out, looking out. And it's like, this seemed orchestrated. There was a group of people who were in a uniform, but not a team uniform. It just seemed weird.
Well, what I found more strange about it was that it was orchestrated purely from one side, in the sense that this was a group of people who had decided, we're going to attack this pub that's filled with young kids, with families, women, their husbands, their children. Like, there was kids in there who obviously had been hurt. But it was from one side. This wasn't a group of fans from both sides who
arranging to meet up,
who absolutely despise each other. We're going to show we're the hard men. Blah blah blah.
Yeah,
like it was done from one end, and this story now that's in the Irish Times. Well, obviously now that adds a totally a different complexion.
Yeah.
On this story.
Yeah, it does. It definitely does. And you'd hope that the Gardaí are in contact with the police service in the UK to find out a bit more about this and to get some intelligence on it. So just to very quickly, here's the exact paragraph. The lack of dedicated public order officers for the game has also caused anger among Gardaí. The lack of officers meant none of the public order tactics to combat disturbances could be used, one source said. So a well-sourced story by Conor Gallagher here saying that the cops were pissed off that there weren't more cops on, which you almost never get.
I actually had that from a friend of mine who was a member of the Gardaí. He even though he brought his kids into the game, and he kind of had noticed that there was significantly fewer members around than you was expecting.
Right.
But there's actually just an interesting point I just spotted here in Dan McDonald of this parish as well, in the Indo. Like, he was just obviously doing kind of like just a commenty piece on it and stuff, but he also says here, like, perhaps regular League of Ireland attendees can be a bit desensitised to the occasional bit of aggro, that it's true that Dublin derbies have been graced by the presence of UK hooligans attracting the basis of tenuous alliances with clubs here, and there are reports suggesting this element had a part to play on Sunday. So that's another kind of element to it.
Yeah. Ireland face Georgia, massive game tonight, obviously. Here's Nathan Murphy catching up with Louise Quinn at full time after our disappointing draw with Slovakia the other night.
Louise, I think most people coming here tonight were expecting all 3 points. Maybe they were expecting Slovakia to be a pushover. It certainly wasn't the case.
No, absolutely not. And we didn't go into the game thinking that either. You know, we've been obviously watching the footage of them, and they are a very, very composed team in possession and brilliant on the counter-attack, and they get a lot of bodies forward when they do it, and they're just really direct, you know, and we really had to kind of keep ourselves solid at those times, and sometimes we weren't. It was a little bit shaky, you know, so we want to be better. I think we obviously were trying to get forward and to get that goal, you know, created those chances. You know, it was a really, really tough game.
It felt a bit frantic the whole way through, that maybe Ireland never quite got the control, particularly midfield, that you would have wanted or maybe would have expected.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. It was just a little bit. We just needed to calm it down in moments, you know. And I think kind of just starting to feel that pressure, because again, we'd be disappointed with the goal that we conceded directly after the half. You know, just kind of, yeah, not switched on, I would say. And, you know, and it's disappointing. So you're trying to really, really build yourself back in, improve on the first half. You know, which we then kind of finally got ourselves into. Obviously, Katie stepping up, doing what she does. You know, and we did create the chances, but it was, you know, it was usually that. And sometimes, you know, I head up top, but we had to keep it secure at the back, to be honest.
The pressure around this game was very different from the two games a month ago, where there was an expectation that Sweden would come, Ireland would defend and maybe just try and nick something, and likewise against Finland, that they would try and get on the ball a lot. The expectation tonight was that Ireland would try and really take the game. Was that a difficulty for the team when you actually get on the pitch, that bit of pressure, that bit of composure? Is that just experience, or what do you put it down to?
Yeah, again, yeah, experience of how to take control of those games with a bit more possession. We knew it was still going to be one where, you know, they were actually going to really go for us and put a lot of pressure on. They close the ball very fast. When they're in possession, they create lovely little triangles. You know, so again, it wasn't for us, obviously, going into it, of what Slovakia maybe used to be, you know, a few years ago, but they've made massive improvements. You know, and it really shows. So yeah, we for ourselves, we've got to impose our game and just be composed and do what we're good at, and we just didn't do that up to enough quality today.
It was a point. It could have been worse. You made the most miraculous goal line clearance. I'm not sure how much you knew about it.
No, I just knew to go get myself on the line, you know, and then yeah, hope to God it hit me, and it did. You know, and that's, yeah, that's, and therefore just to react to that and to, yeah, to keep us in the game, and thankfully I was able to do that.
We all sort of know the expectations around this group, that Sweden should win it, and then it's a battle between Ireland and Finland, and this point means that, you know, still in your own hands. Is that sort of the message that when the players are even getting together there, that like Tuesday is another massive game, that as much as there's disappointment, you can't let this linger?
No, absolutely not. I think it's just going to put the fire in us, to be honest, to know that we have to be better, we can be better. Again, impose our game, be confident on the ball, believe what we're doing, you know, everyone to want this, because, you know, the capabilities, everyone we have in the squad is so capable. You know, and that's also the tough thing with international football. You get a very short amount of time to kind of bring that together at the same time. So, you know, you've got to work fast and work hard. You know, and just some things just didn't come on today. But yeah, listen, we got ourselves back in the game, and we kept the point, and that was really important, and it still keeps us in it, absolutely.
Yeah, the important thing now is you don't get pneumonia, so like, get in quick.
You too.
Good luck.
Yeah, Louise Quinn talking with Nathan in the aftermath of a disappointing performance and results against Slovakia.
It just felt like a bit of a sickener, didn't you? Because there's so much momentum has been building up over the last little while, and the previous camp as well, getting that result against Finland, and obviously the performance against Sweden. And it just, the big important thing for them is that maybe it came in the middle rather than, say, at the end of what happened previously when they had that horrible result out in the Ukraine, wasn't it? Where they just kind of... I think maybe as well on how to be pointed, is there still a bit of a hangover? Is that maybe still in the psyche a little bit? I think maybe Vera Powell needs to get that out of them. Like, but like you could listen to Louise Quinn there, and she was kind of a little bit downbeat, and then obviously can be a bit more positive, because like this game, like they have to win. Like, I know Vera Powell said it's a must win game, and I think she's kind of saying that, I'm guessing, because she knows that they will win. Like, I don't think she would be putting any undue added pressure. Okay. Surely, like,
it's true though.
You know,
well,
like, and like, the other team, haven't scored a goal. They haven't got a point. They're at home. Like,
they're the worst team in the group by a mile.
Yeah,
they're getting hammered by the other teams in the group.
And also, Ireland are a good team. It's not as if that, like, I know obviously they struggled in the last game, but like, they've got quality. Like, they've got Katie McCabe, like Denise O'Sullivan that's in there. Like, they should be more than capable of being that little bit of patience, because I thought it was quite interesting before last week's game, where Vera Powell was talking about the need to be able to still play at a high tempo and to try and impose a game on them, but also being patient and not getting frustrated if maybe things don't happen for them straight away. And I think this is going to be another test of whether or not the players have that, because, and obviously don't get me wrong, it's an early goal, and you would expect the floodgates to maybe open a little bit, or maybe just the pressure to ease. And it's like the longer it goes, where if things are frustrating, that's when maybe some of the other issues that have been there could circulate in a little bit, and it could be a bit more of a tricky night. But I don't see it happening, considering where the both respective teams are at.
There's been a big debate about what the best use of our best players is, and whether or not having Katie McCabe at left back, like she is for Arsenal, is right for Ireland, if actually we don't have the same resources that Arsenal do, and so therefore that is unnecessarily sidelining her, literally and metaphorically, from the game plan. Is tonight an opportunity to maybe see what it would look like if she was playing in a number 10 role or an advanced midfield role, and not just do the same thing?
Like, yeah, like one of the points, like with Katie McCabe, I thought it was quite interesting, like even when she was talking about this as an Arsenal player, like she'd be big into her stats and her running stats, and also kind of that high intensity but in the short bursts, and she kind of says that she's able to impact the game when she's not just going side to side but can actually penetrate, and that's how she knows that she can have an impact. And I think if that's the case, well then you get her into a position on the pitch where she knows that she's going to be most capable of actually impacting, and you saw her goal, great finish as well.
Yeah.
You do have to get her in those positions, and I don't think necessarily anymore with a team that necessarily means, oh well, she has to play maybe as a 10 or a 4 or further forward. If she's in that position where that she's used to playing with Arsenal and knows when she can actually get forward and when she can advance and make those impacts, that's how you do get the best out of her. I don't think you have to change too much, especially if she sees her best way of impacting a game is by doing if from that position.
How do you think Vera Powell's doing at the moment?
Similar to Stephen Kenny in the sense that you get the feeling that the players do all back and believe in what she's doing, and you see the excitement that does is around the women's game. Obviously, that's, I think that's coming as well from you see what's happening with, say, the say some of the sponsorships that are around and the increased publicity. But I think it was maybe clever in a way of playing those the high profile friendly games. Even though they went on that losing run, they were kind of playing the caliber of team that they kind of needed to be up against. Like, let's be honest, like if they win the game, which they should, they're going to be second in the group. They're going to be in the playoff spot. They're going to be where they should be. So in that regard, she's doing well. Again, it comes down to at the end of the campaign. That's when you will judge of how things go, because this win, even though that was a disappointment against Slovakia, they can still end the campaign where they were expecting to end it, and in second place. They might not have a bit more of a buffer there in terms of their points, but it then sets them up going into next year with the four games, with the finishing that, well, actually, that's when you'll know if she's been doing a good job and can see it through if they actually do finish in second place, which would be a tremendous achievement.
Yeah, the disappointment is that we're not going to get to go back into a game against the Swedes where the winning of the group is likely up for grabs because of what happened against Slovakia the last day. You can't really drop points in the group with Sweden there. Mm. And the likelihood is Sweden at home would beat us, and that would be stronger considering they were stronger than us when we played in Dublin. But it'd be nice just to be at that level, wouldn't it, where it's guaranteed you're going to finish second, but you're actually playing for the top of the group.
But that takes a while as well to achieve.
It does.
And even the structures as well, it's very similar in terms of obviously players playing in, say, the WSL in England. Like the fact that there's players obviously who would come through, say, in Ireland, who are playing abroad in America. There is kind of, it's not as if there's like one kind of pathway through and the structure's through. Like, it's going to take a while to develop. And I think at the end of this campaign, if Ireland do finish second and get through it and learn from moments like what happened at the end of the last campaign, learn from moments like what happened in Slovakia, that's the stuff that you would hope will stand to them. And it does look in someone like Katie McCabe that you've got a player who, she's not there already, is very, very quickly, even for a club level as well, is going to be a world-class player and could be someone who will be a serious focal point over the world. She's already captain, so you would expect the horse ceiling, I don't think, has been reached.
No, and even her story, she had a very significant setback, went over to England relatively young, didn't make it at Arsenal at the start. They loan her out, and then she goes and gets game time in an environment where they're like, you're really good, and she's successful, and then goes back. And even then, it's touch and go whether or not she's going to get in the team. And then, it isn't a straightforward, these players, they're going to go, they're going to play this amount of football, they're going to be successful, and they'll be in the national squad. So maybe we should temper our expectations, and I shouldn't be talking about trying to win the group. Finishing second would be great.
Especially with Sweden early in the group as well. But
yeah.
No, I think, I don't think it's a bad thing when there are expectations there, because the players need that. And also, when you have a group of players who have been maybe developed a little bit and coming through together too, like, they'll have those expectations, you know what I mean? I think Ireland haven't qualified for a major tournament, but it does feel as if with how things are going that they are on the cusp of it, but they have to still deliver, when especially in this campaign now. But hook or by crook, they should win against Georgia. But you would like to think that they can turn it on a little bit and give them even a bit more of that boost going into next year, when that's when there'll be a lot more pressure in terms of the business end of the campaign. And you mentioned say Sweden, you would wonder, they've already shown it against Finland, who had a very impressive home record too, that they are capable of going away from home and putting it up. It could be in those games where the onus is on them to have that bit of patience and creativity and nous to get the games where that's where
The style actually suits them.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. David Snaith with us in studio. We're going to talk about the FA Cup final. We'll be joined by Stephen O'Donnell in a few minutes' time. Talk to us about the Keith Buckley, Chris Forrester piece that you had in the 42 at the weekend. It was about 10,000 words, was it?
6,100.
Right, 6,100.
So just over 30,000 fewer than we were actually at the match.
Right, nice. Very good. It was a great piece. If anybody hasn't read this, these two were mates from underage and obviously playing on opposite sides in the cup final, but you brought them through the north inner city and the south inner city, which is kind of where they grew up and where they learned how to play ball. And I thought it spoke a lot about the they talk about themselves being townies or not in Forrester's case.
Yeah, Forrester talk because he's a bit further out near Smith.
Yeah, he's posh. And so that kind of slightly underrepresented aspect of the league, it's a very important part of the history of the League of Ireland.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I just thought as well the fact that obviously it was Pats and Bowes, it was India Viva, it's like I wanted to try and make a bit of a celebration of Dublin a little bit and kind of capture what it was like to be from Dublin. And then obviously it just made, when you realise the two lads who are playing in centre midfield against each other grew up, well, I say grew up, they were kind of playing from when they were 16, 17 at Belvedere together, started at Bowles together, Keith and Chris. And yeah, I just kind of, luckily it took a couple of weeks to arrange. The clubs were obviously great to deal with in terms of doing it. It was just trying to fit it in, because Keith was working the week of the cup final, like right up till Friday. He had Friday off, works as a painter and decorator doing his usual training, so he kind of had that Sunday free to do it, so made sure to fit it in. And yeah, I was just really, really lucky that I'll be honest, it's weird kind of talking about an article you kind of wrote, because as soon as it's done you kind of almost forget about it but you don't want to do too much. But genuinely was absolutely blown away by what people were talking about it on say social media, and with the people of 42, just how happy they are with it. It was just because it kind of exceeded my expectations in the sense of how it worked out and the people that we bumped into. And the two lads are just brilliant. Like, they were great crack from the moment I met them. For it, like, a little bit helps the fact obviously they would know me from covering the league over the last little while, so they knew where I was coming from in terms of what I wanted to do with the article and stuff. And thankfully it didn't rain and it worked well. And
so just explain what you did. You like literally travelled.
Yeah, so I just met the two lads. So obviously, so Chris Forrester is from Paul Street, just off Smithfield Square on the north inner city, and Keith is from Countess Markovich House, just on Townsend Street near Pier Street. And met the two of them at the Halfpenny Bridge, and I just said, right, well, look, I said to them beforehand, obviously arranged, but just think of places where would be important to you that you would like to go to, and we just have a little bit of a chat, and places that from where you, when you would have grown up, or even now that you kind of, that's where you feel most comfortable, you know. And that's what we did. So we just bumped on the Lewis at Jervis, even before that, bumping into Uncle Michael, Uncle Mick, who was Keith's dad's brother. And this is what I think made the article, in terms of why people have kind of resonated with a lot of people, was just the fact that the two lads were so open in what they were talking about and how they were speaking, but then also the people along the way. And none of it was actually staged. Like, even before I turned up, the only place that I knew for definite I was going to was obviously the Halfpenny Bridge. Other than that, it was like, you just take me where you want to go, right, and whatever, and just see how the conversation went. I kind of had an idea of little themes I wanted to go through in terms of the article, but it was just have to chat with them and see where it went. And then I kind of realised within about 5 minutes that I kind of struck gold with it, especially when Monkey got involved, and then seeing Chris's young daughter Isabel, and then Keith's dad, and then Evan, the referee, who kind of nearly got knocked down by two Lewises to get involved with the conversation, which is pretty funny. But it was just the two lads and their families just made, and I'll be honest, it was genuinely the easiest thing I've ever had to write in terms of just transcribing it, because like the story was there from the day, like you didn't have to, you just let it flow and let them go with it, because like they were so good and they were so open, and even chatting how they were talking to each other and stuff. It was just brilliant, and it was just a bit of a privilege to be there with them as well, especially to kind of add to the coverage for the cup final, because there was so much great stuff written from lads about it too. And obviously Stephen O'Donnell's going to be on. He did a great interview with Padge, like his closest mate from himself, with Dan and McDonald and Dean and stuff, and see Neil O'Reilly was running good stuff. All the lads, like there was just so much good coverage, because like it's one of the benefits of the league in terms of when you, a lot of lads trust you so much, like, you know, they know that they want it, you do want to portray things in a good light, but also get those stories across and get the sense of what it is to be in the league, because I think sometimes maybe it's kind of underestimated, just the value that it has.
Yeah, and even the different circumstances where one of them is a full-time footballer and one of them is a painter decorator. This is again, it's the type of stuff that you would have known instinctively about a lot of GAA players, that they have jobs, because it gets talked about all the time. Yeah, so it gets talked about all the time about their jobs, but that is kind of, it's less spoken about with regards to the League of Ireland. And it feels to me a little bit like the league is in a crossover phase, where it's crossing over from being niche to something that's far more mainstream, even though it was always kind of, it was the steady drumbeat of matches and fixtures and scores was always there. But you can only do that if the personality of the people involved becomes something that resonates with the wider public. I don't know what it's like for you in the middle of that.
Yeah, like, no, you do, you kind of, like, say for, again, I don't want to be coming across kind of maybe self-important about it, but I could kind of realise after the interview, I was like, that I did have something good with it, and I was like, I wanted to try and get this across really well, cause, and make sure that people who are already, that's why I kind of said, I remember when I tweeted out just saying like, welcome to Dublin, because it just felt as if like this was the best side of what Dublin, inner city Dublin, and the people who are there, and the footballers who are there, and even like, again, like, it's, I'm talking to myself here, but even like, the fact that like, my dad would be from Broadstone, and like, even like, he was delighted with it, and I think that made, that kind of meant, even the two lads and their families were, and all like, the lads who got back to me about it, I was just happy that they liked it, and even getting that little thing from like, my old dad, who'd be from around that, not too far from where Chris is from, that like, even his mates then, because he played for Sheriff, like, and then his mates who wouldn't necessarily always be reading what he'd be writing or whatever, were getting in touch saying, bang on the money, like, and I kind of like, that's, I want to try and get that authenticity about it across, which I hope we managed to deal with the lads, and because they are, like, that's what I'm saying, like, there was nothing, it's not bullshit with them, like, they were just honest and pure up, and it was great, like.
Yeah, in a way, that's what the league needs. It needs that.
But that's what it is. That's the thing. This is what the league is about. Like, I remember a while ago, and even someone who, I absolutely hated it, the tagline, real football, real fans. Because I think if you're trying to entice people in and get people excited about it, you're going to piss off people, the whole Barstooler thing. Like, someone like myself who would have, like, I love League of Ireland. I've been going to League of Ireland since I was a kid, but then I'd also have a real love for English football as well, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So like, but I think how you might get people involved, other than the fact that there's some really good footballers in the league and the football's being played, and obviously Stephen O'Donnell is one of them, in terms of players who've come back, and like, a progressive coach who kind of gets playing and is able to revitalise the club, like, that's all happening on the pitch. Like, when people are there, it's because of what's around it as well, that you kind of do need to do a bit more with, and trying to sell and get the whole sense of that belonging and a feeling to it, but getting people but making those people who do come into it, making them know they can belong to it straight away. It's not as if you're,
there's no barrier to entry.
There really isn't, and I think there's a myth about that that annoys me a little bit as well, that people think if you rock up to the Camac on Richmond Park, or if you go to Daly Mill Park, that they'd be looked at saying, what are you doing here? Like, I've never seen that happen. Clubs need fans for our people, and fans who are there realise that as well, that every kind of body through the turnstile is going to lead to a more stable club and a more stable kind of sustainable kind of model for football in the country, like, you know. What I mean?
So again, so Stephen isn't going to join us this morning, by the way. He's cancelled at the last minute, and we'll hopefully get him on the next day or two. But what's your view on? So put the cup final in context for us, right? We've seen Irish crowds come out for one-off occasions in the past in different sports, and it's used sometimes as a barometer. Everything's great because we're able to hit these record crowds, but actually the truth is it's a one-off thing and everything gets funneled that way. It seems that over the last three or four seasons, and over the last, well, maybe since Dundalk made a breakthrough, that actually although that wasn't particularly sustainable, but the game itself at a domestic level is getting organised. There are more good quality people involved in the administration of the clubs than there ever have been, that they realise that it needs to be sustainable, and that it can't just be a massive injection of cash that you give to the players and then those players leave and then there's nothing.
Yeah. That's it, like, it can't be like that. I can't do the whole boom and bust. But I do think as well, like, it was great, obviously, 37,000 people who were at the Aviva at the weekend for the final. Part of the reason would be is that it's two clubs who are trying to connect properly and put proper resources into what they do around their communities, and that can't be scoffed at, because that's what they're, the values that are needed. Like, the culture that needs, how you have to build it for a while, is the fact that going to watch a match on a Friday night is part of your life, you know what I mean? Like, you might have a good season, like Dundalk have a good season for quite a few seasons, and you'll naturally get people who want to be attracted to that success. But when it does fade away, which is the nature of football, well, who's going to be left, and what is it if they're only there because of the success? Well, they'll be the first ones to go, and if 60, 70% are only there because they kind of get to see a team that's winning or whatever, well, then you're in trouble. It's like, well, how do you create that bond and that feeling and an affinity? And it's from such a young age. That's why everything, the perfect storm that's come with Brexit and all the rest. One thing that struck me this weekend was the amount of young people who are there, obviously with their families, because of obviously how tickets were done was spot on too as well. But I think the fact now that League of Ireland clubs have to put significant resources in to academy football and for youngsters with football, that's such an important thing. Like, if for so long, like when I was growing up, to be clubs like wouldn't really have had even a schoolboy team, like, you know what I mean? And
there
you wouldn't,
no reason for kids to identify with, like, the local,
yeah, like, only, like, the only reason why I would have went to watch, say, St. Pat's growing up was because I was brought there by family. I lived in Luke and it was the closest team to me. But, like, I could have easily, if that never happened, I never would have went, really, other than maybe as you get a bit older and you meet friends and you go with friends, and
yeah,
that's the natural progression. But that's what has to happen with football, like, in terms of with the League of Ireland. When you see it's great, but it has to be bottom up. You can't, it's not going to just be top down where you have 37,000 at the cup final, but you need to have a sustainable in terms of having people coming through because they actually feel that connection with a club and see that clubs are doing that constant, are constantly out there in their communities with the different kind of projects that they would do. But also now, and it's going to be the biggest thing, which is so obvious, is because there's going to be so many kids now coming through playing for every League of Ireland club through academies from the age of 13 up and even younger, with their, it's only going to be so natural now that they're going to feel that bond to a club, and the families are, yeah, so used to it. And that if they're there training during the week and then they have the game, like, that Friday nights and going to games is part of their culture of the club. And it's hopefully, I don't think it'll, hopefully think you, we see a huge boost in it in the next few years, but even if it is over the next 10 years where you steadily see it, that's what you would naturally need to happen now.
So we have to stick with the plan that has been instigated, even though Rude Doctor is leaving.
Well, yeah, because there's a huge opportunity there. And I think if you see what's happening with, say, with Brexit, and, like, that's not going to change. Like, there's not going to be,
no, they ain't going back.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's it. And you have to, and, like, obviously, so Irish football is playing catch up majorly. The thing, the issue that I would have and think that could maybe be a big worry is that, say, there's lads all coming through the system of the academy system. You don't want to just have it as, like, a mini system of what happens in the UK, where there's so many stories of heartbreak of kids who don't make it and then they feel totally disillusioned with the club. There has to be a link where the club and playing football, yeah, for some of them, they know that from maybe 15, 16, that there's a serious chance there for them to progress and have a career. But those others still feel part that they actually belong to the club. And while they might not make it as players, which most of them won't, that they're not just discarded, and that they don't just, because, like, even writing, say, articles so many times of lads who've gone away to England, and in the League of Ireland, a fourth level is a place where they rebuild their lives, they rebuild their careers as footballers. But now you're going to have that point where there'll be lads coming through and they're going to be having that feeling already here. So yeah, they haven't got those League of Ireland clubs to turn to, or haven't got that feeling.
Well, you'd hope that the Irish clubs will have a more rounded approach towards education and think that, like, you can't, you know, it's probably easier for an English club to look at their multinational makeup kids and think, well, I'm never going to see you again. Where, at least in Ireland, it's like,
and that's happening. Like,
the lads and dads will be knocking around to the coaches, going, you know, what is he going to do after this?
Well, that's it. Well, and this is the thing. Like, clubs have had it with tour level institutions for so long. Like, so many clubs have links. Like, say, Jamie McGrath, who would have come through and had a scholarship at Maynooth and got his degree through Maynooth and then played for, obviously, Pat's Dundalk and now for Ireland. But what's happening now in Rovers, I think, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure Rovers were the first where their academy lads had, where some of their academy lads were getting education at secondary level, private school in South Dublin. So they were able to train full time. And I suppose the most high profile proponent of that is Gavin Bazunu.
Yeah.
Like, he was able to stay here a bit longer. And I think he would have done his leaving cert here, other than, I think, Man City realised how good he was. Like, no, we actually want you a bit sooner, because the original plan was for him to stay with Rovers, play a bit longer, because he had signed the kind of pre-contract where it was, do his leaving cert here and then go over. But then, because they realised what they had in their hands, they're like, no, we'll get you over now. So with Rovers, I know Pats are in the process, I think, of doing something similar. Other clubs, you can be sure, are doing it as well.
Yeah.
And that's like UCD have just been promoted. Like, the amount of players that UCD have produced for the league, behind the whole thing of the scholarships and being able to have that education, like, there is the education, I think, has to be linked at the forefront with young lads coming through now, because first of all, even if they do make it as professional footballers, that's not going to set them up for the rest of their life.
No.
So how are you going to entice people to stay here, who have to stay here to continue their football education, when you're still putting those building blocks in place? It's by making sure, especially with families and, you know, as a parent as well, if you know your kid's going to get looked after with an education, a good education at secondary level, and then has the process to play football and go to college and have something behind them, like, it just seems like the most obvious way forward. But then you're changing years and years of thinking of how you do become a footballer.
Yeah, big opportunity to do that, though, given everything that's happened.
Oh, massive.
You know, especially when there isn't going to be a pipeline there for our best young players to go to England as early as they did.
And sorry, as well with education, what I think is even more important would be, like, because there's so much, like, clubs have to do so much now to actually get their facilities up to scratch for training whilst playing football, but also having full time coaches. So, like, what can you offer kids then that's ready to go and there? And it's an education infrastructure.
Yeah.
So if that's the thing that you can always use as a bit of time to buy time to actually get your house in order on the football side of things, but that's how you do it, and that's what's going to be giving parents a much more of a reason to want their kids to stay, which they obviously have to, I suppose, until they're 18. But also, it gives kids a bit of a focus as well, knowing that they're not just training a few times a week and they have to stay here and they're falling so far behind. They also have something there that's backing them up.
Yeah, okay. A lot of people speculating about where Stephen O'Donnell is going to end up next year, and who is going to end up with the Dundalk job. Different stories in the papers over the last couple of days. Steve Staunton was linked with the job yesterday. Stephen O'Donnell was linked with the Dundalk job. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, this is interesting, because obviously it would have been great to talk to him about this. Like, even before he was coming on, obviously it was put to me by someone very close to the club that he's going to be staying on as manager,
right,
and that he's going to be there for at least another couple of years now, and it's something that has to get fleshed out over the next couple of days.
So it's very difficult to turn your back on something when you've just started a period of success and when you've had an immediate impact. Like, you know, Chris Forrester was saying, we were the only ones who put it up to Rovers in your piece the weekend. Yeah. Like, it's true, right?
Well, yeah, it is, because they were second. They still finished like 15, 16 points behind, but it got to that stage in the season when Rovers did win at Richmond Park and scored a late goal. That's when they pulled away, and that was relatively late. So the gap is a bit misleading. I do think Rovers obviously were the best team in the country. But yeah, no, Pats are like, it was very telling after the game on Sunday, the fact that Ian Birmingham came in, Lee Desbin came in, Darragh Burns, three players came in, and Darragh Burns, who's the youngest, is the only one who's under contract. And both Lee and Ian Birmingham just were talking about how basically Stephen O'Donnell had totally revitalised the club and had brought it in a direction that they didn't think was possible after what had happened for a couple of years before that, where they kind of lost its way, and he kind of got a bit of grip. And like, he was big enough about the fact that Robbie Benson was a major factor in that, getting him from Dundalk when he could have stayed there. They'd been obviously winning stuff. He was willing to come and believed in O'Donnell. And he, I think before the week of the match, a couple of weeks of the match, when he had decided to play this kind of box midfield formation of like Alfie Lewis and Jamie Lennon on front of the back four with Chris Forrester and Robbie Benson kind of above that, with kind of both of them kind of acting as a false nine, he kind of said, do you trust me? Do you believe that this, do you trust me that this is going to work or whatever? And they're all like, yeah, 100%. Like, they're all behind, because they've seen the work that's gone in. And anyone who's been at Richmond Park over the last while, the transformation in the mentality around the place and just how they're playing, it's just been, it's been staggering.
And there'll be European football there. Like, it's a big thing to turn your back on.
Yeah.
And to go to a situation in Dundalk where, like, certainly the stories that we've been hearing, not quite convinced that the budget's going to be there, that everybody thinks it's going to be there, that expectations are going to be slightly out of kilter. It's a team, it's a group of fans and supporters who assume that success is going to get back to the level that it was at in the glory days, but, like, they need to rebuild. And there's been a lot of expense. You know, it's just interesting to see exactly what happens there. Like, sometimes building something that's yours is better than going to somewhere which on the face of it is supposed to be bigger but isn't.
Yeah, and it's a very good point. And I think also the fact that where they are relative at the moment and how far they are along, like, I think, like, Dundalk's going to be a serious job on their hands. They've lost quite a significant number of players and important players who have made such a big difference, like obviously Michael Duffy, Patrick McElhenney going to Derry. Like, there's going to be that Derry challenge coming next year, which is going to be quite very, very, very interesting. But like, Pat's, like, O'Donnell, like, if he does, if that is sorted out now in the next few days and he's going to be staying on, like, he's not going to have much of a break in terms of over Christmas. He's going to have a few players there that he does need to get signed up. But the fact is, I don't think he's going to have much convincing to do either.
That's it.
You know, so
yeah,
they kind of see where they're at. And, like, even for him, for Stephen, like, he kind of is at a stage as well where he's still relatively, it is, it's still not novice, but it's a burgeoning coaching career, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think he needs to jump at another rebuilding job straight away when he's in the process of actually maybe very close to taking a next step with Pats.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it'd be great to see him, how he would do in European football next year with that, and just to see what level of progress they can do and how much of a title charge they can make next season. David, good stuff. Thanks for joining us today. Cheers.
My pleasure.
Check out David's piece on the 42 from the weekend as well. Even in retrospect, it's a great piece as well.
OTB AM
with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's move.